Hi, this is Kevin Craig. Elsewhere on this website is a video, or I mean an audio, that tells you who I am. But in this audio, I want to tell you about the Samuel Adams coaching program. Specifically, we have a 95-day orientation program in which we tell you five things you need to know and five books you need to read to become an extraordinary American, an extraordinary Christian, and an extraordinary human being, the three goals of Samuel Adams in the first letter he sent to America through a network of communication known as the Committees of Correspondence. In the next 95 days, if you enroll in the program, we'll be reading through the entire Bible in chronological order. And at that time, we'll be asking three important questions. And you'll see those three questions emerge in the outline I'm about to present to you. This is what we'll be talking about for the next 95 days. Just a little bit at a time, a little bit each day, but the cumulative effect of this orientation program will, I hope, be that you will want to really dive in deeper and enroll in the entire Samuel Adams one-year, 365-day program to read the five of the most important works in the history of Western civilization, five of the most important works in the history of America, and the five things you need to know in the next 95 days will basically tell you you need to sign up for the Samuel Adams coaching program. So here's an overview, the five things you need to know about our program. Thing number one, the three goals for you from Samuel Adams and why you must achieve them in that letter I mentioned earlier. Thing number two, three subjects banned from your government-approved education and why you must now access them. Thing number three, the three huge mistakes America's founding fathers made and why you must avoid them. Thing number four, the three most hated words in politics today and why you must adopt them. And finally, thing number five, the three things you need to become extraordinary and why you must activate them. So let's start with thing number one, the three challenges of Samuel Adams in that first letter he wrote through the Committees of Correspondence. He said, we, that is, Americans. Well, actually, Englishmen at that time. He said Englishmen. The three things he said Americans should do should be to guard their rights as Englishmen, guard their rights as Christians, and guard their rights as men. Well, I've updated that a little bit, and I'm saying that our goal should be to be an extraordinary American, an extraordinary Christian, and an extraordinary human being. So let's look at the first goal, to be a real American. What is a real American? Who is a real American? Somebody who wants to redistribute all property and all industry and let it be owned by the state, is that an American? I think not. That's a socialist or a communist. So there is something, there's some content to what a real American is. A real American would have been defined in 200 years ago as someone who believed in the American dream. Today, the American dream is paying $250,000 in interest on a 30-year mortgage. 200 years ago, having a mortgage would have been seen as a tragedy, not the American dream. The real American dream, in the words of America's founding fathers repeatedly, was everyone owning his own vine and fig tree, living securely under his own vine and fig tree, words from the Bible. A real American certainly believes that the Declaration of Independence is really true, and I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but the reason why you're a victim of educational malpractice is because you're a product of an education system in which the federal government prohibits local public school teachers from teaching students that the Declaration of Independence is really true. Students can be taught that a bunch of dead white guys used to believe it was true, with the implication being that we, of course, we're much more sophisticated than they were back then. You can teach the Declaration of Independence is an irrelevant historical artifact, even though many people are inspired by the Declaration of Independence, whatever inspired means. But surely a real American believes that it's actually true. It's true whether or not anybody even believes it's true. It's true because it's objectively true. What does the Declaration of Independence say? It says that we have a duty, not just a right, but a duty to abolish any government that becomes a tyranny. So a real American opposes tyranny and notes that what a tyranny is a government that is any bigger than the government that existed in 1776, which I hasten to tell you was a radically libertarian Christian government compared to the government we have today. Most people who live in America today demand tyranny. They don't resist it. They demand it. They want the freebies. They want something for nothing. They want the wealth of other people to be redistributed to them by the state. That is the essence of tyranny, and Americans today demand it. A real American opposes tyranny. A real American opposes tyranny at the very first hint of tyranny. People will call him an alarmist just because he thinks that, oh, well, just because we have this, that we're on some kind of slippery slope into tyranny. Well, James Madison, the father of the Constitution, said that we take alarm at the first infringement of our liberties, the first hint that a government has tyrannical impulses. A real American prefers liberty under God to any promise of security under man. And Franklin and others said that anyone who would exchange liberty for security deserves neither. A real American is willing to risk something to protect liberty under God. He's willing to risk his life, his fortune, his reputation, sacred honor. In short, an American takes action. A real American is also a Christian. America's founding fathers said that. And they also noted that America was a Christian nation built on Christian principles. Of course, a Buddhist can be a very helpful person, can be a nice person, can contribute to America's greatness by inventing things or doing good works or something like that. But if we took his religion seriously and consistently, we would not be America any longer, because America is a Christian nation. Adams' second goal in his letter through the committees of correspondence was to be a genuine Christian. At least that's how I'm taking it. He said we should guard our rights as Christians. Our rights as Christians are found in the New Testament, he said. But I would just say we need to ask ourselves whether we're Christians at all. Jesus frequently told people that despite their thoughts, their hopes, their aspirations, or their belief, that he never knew them. They were not real Christians. So it's something we need to examine ourselves. What is a true Christian? A true Christian is a follower of Christ. The word Christ means anointed king. Christ is also called the Prince of Peace. So there's a kind of governmental aspect to Christ. The phrase Prince of Peace comes from Isaiah. So a real Christian is somebody who takes the Bible seriously. Here's an interesting one, and we'll be looking at this one in more detail. A true Christian is not an archist. In Mark chapter 10, the disciples were arguing about who was going to be the most politically powerful person in the kingdom of God, and Jesus said they got it all wrong, that the real great ones in the kingdom of God are not those who are like pharaohs and Caesars and Führers and czars and prime ministers, but they are servants. Jesus said the kings of the Gentiles like to be archists. That's the Greek word there in Mark chapter 10. If you haven't figured it out, what English word is derived from that, we'll find out in a minute. But a Christian is not an archist. A Christian is a servant. A genuine Christian is not afraid to be called a pacifist. Remember, we worship the Prince of Peace. The word pacifist simply comes from the Latin word for peace. We're supposed to love our enemies. We're supposed to be at peace with all men. Peace is a major theme in the Bible, and we'll be talking about this as we go along. A genuine Christian is not afraid to be called an extremist. Jesus said, I wish you were either hot or cold, but you're lukewarm, you're a moderate, and it makes me want to vomit you out of my mouth. A true Christian is not afraid to be called a theocrat. The word theocracy means God rules. God makes the decision. God is our ruler. And America's founding fathers said, God is our ruler. The ruler of all nations, Washington said. If we are a nation under God, then God is over us as a ruler. And so any nation that claims to be under God is claiming to be a theocracy. The Declaration of Independence plainly states that America, the United States, is a theocracy, a government under God. A true Christian is a theonomist. Have you heard that word, theonomy? It's not a question of whether you will be under law or not. The question is whose law. You are always under someone's law. God is our sovereign. God is our lawmaker, according to Isaiah, and we are under God's law. The true Christian is forgiven by imputation. There's a word that most public school graduates have never heard and certainly don't understand. We're forgiven by the righteousness of Christ imputed to us, not what we earn by going to church and doing certain rituals and lighting the incense and whatever. A true Christian, according to Matthew 25, read that last part of the chapter carefully. A true Christian performs works of mercy, otherwise you're a goat and you're sent to an unpleasant place. A true Christian does not believe in justification by mere belief. A true Christian believes in justification by allegiance. That's a critical concept. We'll talk about that. True Christian judges one religion to be true and all others to be false. That's what Jesus said. There's only one way. America's founding fathers frequently spoke of the true religion and denounced false religions. Finally, a true Christian is a Berean. That is to say, every day he questions what he hears from others in light of the Bible. So Samuel Adams' first goal was to be a real American, to be a real Christian, and finally to be a real human being, a genuine human being, what human beings were really meant to be. So what is the chief end of man? A question every child in America could understand and answer with the same answer in 1776, because every single classroom in America had a copy of the Shorter Catechism, and that was question number one. What is the chief end of man, the chief goal, the chief purpose of man? The answer was to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. You don't glorify God if you think you're God. So there's a certain humility there that I think most politicians in America lack. Enjoying God forever means having some sense of gratitude for what God has given us, all the gifts God gives us. The first command in the garden was for human beings to exercise dominion over the earth. We don't worship the earth, we exercise dominion over the earth. We're not environmentalists. Jesus said to do business. I think the King James Version translated, occupy till I come. The Greek word there is to do business. So a true Christian is involved in raising the standard of living of others by engaging in productive activity, which others are willing to pay for, not wasting talents, but being a good and faithful servant. The Bible teaches there is a division of labor. We each have certain gifts. The division of labor works best when we specialize, when we have freedom to exercise a lawful calling and do the things that God commanded us to do, that God empowered us, that the talents that God, with which we were endowed by our Creator, to use the Declaration of Independence language. Finally, our goal should be to please God in everything we do, to please God. So that's the first thing, those three challenges from Samuel Adams. There really is such a thing as a real American and a real Christian, and we should strive to be every bit of the human being that God created us, created in the image of God. Thing number two, and you'll notice that each of these things have three things, three items, three subpoints, just to make it easy for you. Thing number two is the three subjects banned from your government-approved education. And the reason why you're a victim of educational malpractice is because you're a victim of an education system which removed the three most important things that education is supposed to have. America's founding fathers believe that every public school education should teach three things if it teaches nothing else. And in fact, everything else that's taught in school is simply a means to the end. Being able to read is not important if you don't read anything. Knowing how to do math is not important if you never do any math. What's important are these three things, and they're found in America's organic law, and that's not law that relates to agriculture. That's the most profound, basic, fundamental charters of our nation's existence. And those charters, if you go to a law library and you say to the librarian, I want to look at America's organic law, she'll bring you the first volume of the United States Code, the statute book, and that first volume contains the organic law of the country. And that includes charters like the Declaration of Independence and the Articles of Confederation, the Constitution, and the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. The Northwest Ordinance was a blueprint for the states. Whenever a territory wanted to become a state, it would be given an enabling act by Congress, and Congress would say, make sure your state constitution is consistent with the principles of the Declaration of Independence and the Northwest Ordinance. And the Northwest Ordinance says that religion, and of course they did not mean the religion of Osama bin Laden, they meant Christianity, morality, and knowledge are necessary for good government and the happiness of mankind. Therefore, schools and the means of education shall always be promoted or encouraged. And that language from the Northwest Ordinance was found word for word in many state constitutions, all the way up until Nebraska was admitted in 1875. So this is basic. When the United States Supreme Court removed religion from public schools, particularly in the early 1960s, one of the justices, Justice Douglas, admitted that America's founding fathers believed that the primary purpose of public school education was to teach religion, morality, and knowledge. But religion and morality have been banned. Religion, you can't teach religion. and morality based on religion, which is thou shalt or thou shalt not, saith the Lord, that has been banned. And the court admitted that America's founding fathers believed that the primary purpose of public schools was to teach religion and morality. You go back to the very first public school laws in this country, and they specifically say that that old deluder Satan has always tried to keep people ignorant of the scriptures. And so we're going to make sure that we have schools to teach the Bible. That's the whole reason why we have public or common schools, was to make sure everybody knew the Bible and religion and morality and knowledge. And knowledge, and again, I say knowledge does not mean reading or writing or arithmetic. It means knowing how the world works and being able to oppose, for example, to oppose mercantilism. That was why the United States, the colonies, rebelled against Britain, was because Britain was engaging in economic mercantilism. That's what we need to know. So let's look at those three things that were banned from your government-approved education: religion, morality, and knowledge of the way the world works, knowledge of the reasons why freedom and liberty are better than mercantilism and socialism. First of all, as I said, we're talking about the religion of Jesus Christ, not the religion of Osama bin Laden. Religion in this case is a vertical relationship between human beings and God. And America's founding fathers believed that atheism was a bad thing. Atheists were banned from public office. And our nation was pervasively aware of the fact that we were a nation under God and that we had duties to God. And that's that vertical, the vertical aspect of religion, is that you have a relationship to God. You were created. You are not simply the result of impersonal, cold, blind, random forces, but you're created and endowed by your Creator with talents and privileges and what America's founding fathers called rights. Man is not God. Man's governments are not God. There is a distinction between the Creator and the creation. Another aspect of religion, which America's founding fathers understood, was that man is broken. There was this thing, an event called the fall. And as a result of the fall, human beings are born with sinful inclinations. And those sinful inclinations are perhaps most readily seen in capitals, in governments. This was something America's founding fathers understood. Another aspect of religion is atonement. We all know, because we see the work of the law written on our heart when we judge one another, we all know that we ourselves are sinners and that we need atonement. We need our relationship with God to be healed. When we do not receive atonement through Christ, we tend to seek atonement in other ways. If we know that we've done something wrong, then we try to atone for that, sometimes by punishing ourselves or by punishing others. And the politics of sadomasochism is a very important dynamic in politics today. We'll look at, briefly, an important book that talks about the politics of guilt and pity. We'll also look at another book that talks about the relationship between the one and the many. What is more important? Politicians and political scientists have been asking this question for centuries. What is more important, the rights of an individual or the security of the nation? What's more important, the unity of the group or the diversity, individuality, and plurality of the many? Well, that's a question that can only be answered by Christianity, and we'll find out why on day 31 of our 95-day orientation in the Samuel Adams coaching program. Three things were necessary to every common school education: religion, morality, and knowledge. Religion is our vertical relationship to God, and morality is our horizontal relationship with other human beings. And it's morality that is the source of what America's founding fathers called rights. And we'll talk about this in just a minute. Also, there's a concept of national morality, that our entire nation was to be committed to a common system of morality. George Washington said that our national morality cannot prevail without religion. And John Adams said that our nation needed to repent of its sins, and this should be done as a nation, as a whole. So there's that definite importance attached by America's founding fathers to morality, which basically cannot be taught in a public school today as America's founding fathers understood it. You can't go in front of a student, in front of a classroom in public school and say, God says, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. You can't say that God says those things and that's why you should not steal. Religion, morality, and knowledge. As I said, knowledge doesn't just mean reading, writing, and arithmetic. Knowledge means a knowledge of how the world works, how God works in the world, the invisible hand of divine providence, as described in the Declaration of Independence, why government intrusion in the form of mercantilism or today forms of socialist central planning do not work. Knowledge in this context is knowledge of how to discharge a lawful calling, how to do work that's productive and valued by other people, how to do things that help raise other people's standard of living. That's what children were supposed to be taught in school, is how to be a productive member of a division of labor society under liberty, under capitalism. So that's thing number two, the three things that were banned from your school, the three things that the three reasons why you are a victim of educational malpractice, because you were denied the kind of knowledge of the religion of Jesus Christ that teenagers had that today most seminary graduates do not have. Thing number three, the three huge mistakes America's founding fathers made and why you must avoid them. We have a lot of respect for the Founding Fathers here at Samuel Adams Coaching Program. That's why we've named it after Samuel Adams. They had a lot of good things to say, and we have lost a lot of their greatness. But we don't worship the Founding Fathers because they made at least three huge mistakes. I'm going to talk about three mistakes that are totally crippling and destroying America today. Huge mistake number one, constitutional rights. That's right, constitutional rights, maybe I should say that's correct. Constitutional rights was a mistake. In the Bible, there's no such thing as rights. Rights have morphed into the modern-day concept of entitlements. We all think we have a right, that we're entitled to a college degree, a cushy job, high paying, low demands, healthcare, miraculous technology. We're entitled to everything we want, basically. And this entitlement mentality is an offspring of the rights mentality, and the rights mentality is wrong, and here's why. Start off with something pretty basic. There is no such thing as a right to life. You say, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Except it's true. We don't have a right to life, and nobody ever walked up to the Creator and said, hey, I have a right to life. Create me. We don't have a right to life. The Bible says we forfeited our life, that we deserve death because of our rebellion against the Creator. What we have in life is a gift. Property is not a right. Property is a gift. We are stewards of property by the gift and the grace of God. What we want in society is for other people to acknowledge and practice their duty. Not that we have a right to life, but we want other people to acknowledge that God says, thou shalt not kill to them, and that they have a duty not to take our life. We want other people to acknowledge that God says they have a duty not to steal that which God has entrusted to us as stewards, our property. It's duties that make our society prosperous, that give us liberty. We don't have any rights. We don't have any freedoms. If everybody in our society thinks that they are their own God and they can kill anyone who gets in their way, they can take anything that they want. It's duties that makes for a prosperous society, not rights. And the concept of rights has morphed, has mutated into the concept of entitlements. Politicians say, you're entitled to this, you're entitled to that, I'll get it for you if you vote for me. And we now have hundreds of trillions of dollars of unfunded entitlement and other liabilities that are going to create economic meltdown for America. Rights was a huge mistake. Huge mistake number two, revolution. The Founding Fathers said, we have rights, and when a government infringes on our rights, we have the right to get our muskets out and kill the tax collectors, kill the redcoats. Violent revolution against the state. Completely unchristian. The New Testament is really clear that we're to submit to governments. We are to render unto Caesar. We're to pay the taxes, as Romans 13 says. We don't get out our muskets. We don't overthrow the government. Not only was it wrong for the American Revolution, for our founding fathers to get out their muskets and kill Christians from Britain, But it's wrong for the government today to go over to Iran and overthrow the government of Iran for the benefit of petroleum corporations. And that's what happened. That's what the United States federal government did in 1953. And it's basically resulted in the whole Middle East mess, including terrorism, that we see today. The United States has tried to overthrow numerous governments, sometimes successfully, sometimes unsuccessfully, sometimes after long, protracted civil wars with lots of people dying, lots of property destroyed, lots of liberties lost. What a mess it has been ever since 1776. We would be much better off if we had stayed under Britain, and instead, the United States has been an example for other nations to go socialist. In many ways, the big bad governments of the 20th century were the products of the United States federal government. The United States propped up the Soviet Union for years. The United States has brought into being numerous governments which were totally evil and unchristian governments. It's this whole idea that we have the right to overthrow a government by violence rather than suffering like Christ did. Huge mistake number three. We've seen the mistake of rights, the mistake of revolution. Once the founding fathers abolished the government, okay, they shouldn't have done that, but having done that, what did they do? They replaced it with another government. In fact, a government that turned out to be much worse than the one they abolished by violence. So the restoration of this idea of representative regulation was another mistake. Why? Why is that a mistake? Aside from the fact that the United States turned out to be worse than Britain was, it was a mistake because nobody has the right to claim to represent groups of people and be given a privilege, much less a monopoly, to engage in violence. And that's what governments claim. They claim a right to engage in violence, and they claim a monopoly of violence. They claim the right to take your money by force, which would otherwise be theft or robbery. Now, the Founding Fathers made three mistakes, but they also did not make a mistake that we're making today. The bonus non-mistake, I'm calling it, is that they did not believe in this thing called the rapture. They did not believe in a way of looking at things which we might call pessimillennialism. Benjamin Rush, who signed the Declaration of Independence, said he thought that they were creating a system that would last for the ages. The Great Seal of the United States contains the Latin words Novus Ordo Seclorum, a new order for the ages. They thought they were doing something that would last for hundreds of years, centuries into the future, a new way of organizing society that was a breakaway from previous centuries and something that would light the way of mankind for centuries to come. They did not believe that you don't polish brass on a sinking ship. They did not believe that everything was going to be destroyed at Armageddon. That whole way of looking at things, America's Founding Fathers did not make that mistake. We're making that mistake today. Thing number four, the three most hated words in politics today and why you must embrace them, even though everyone's going to hate you for it. They're going to hate you for saying there's no such thing as constitutional rights. They're going to hate you for saying that the American Revolution was a sinful violation of Romans 13. They're probably going to hate you for saying that people don't have the right to tax. So we might as well come up front and really come to grips with these issues. The first hated word, the first most hated word in the mainstream media today is theocracy. If you go to your public school superintendent or to the school board and you say, I want students in public schools to be taught that the Declaration of Independence really is true, that the existence of God really is a self-evident truth, that God revealed moral absolutes, the laws of nature and of nature's God, that the little kids in public school better think about the laws of nature and of nature's God, because otherwise they're going to meet the supreme judge of the world. They want children to be taught in public school that our rights are the product of intelligent design. You can't teach that. They want students to be understood to understand the word providence, that we can have a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. If you want students in public schools to be taught that the Declaration of Independence is really true, people will accuse you of trying to impose a theocracy. And we've been brainwashed. We say, no, I don't want to impose a theocracy. I'm against theocracy. No, you're not. If you're a Christian, you're for theocracy. You're for God being our governor. You're for God being our ruler and for us obeying God's commandments. And that's what a theocracy is. We've been trained to think that a theocracy is Iran or something like that. There's a difference between a Christian theocracy and a Muslim theocracy. And a Christian theocracy is a good thing. Being a nation under God, the God of the Bible, not the God of some other holy book, is a good thing. And that's what America's founding fathers wanted America to be, a nation under the true God and not under the false religions of other gods. So the antidote to the first mistake America's founding fathers made about rights, which is morphed into entitlements, is our duties. And our duties come from God, and they come from the true God and not from a false God. And so be prepared if you're really functioning as an intelligent and consistent Christian to be called an advocate of theocracy or a theocrat. The second most hated word stems from our understanding in the Bible that we are to render unto Caesar, we're to pay our taxes, we are to be subject to governments, we are to be subject to empires, we are to be subject to brutal military dictatorships, and we don't have a Second Amendment right. This is going to call you, they're going to call you a pacifist if you say that, but that's clearly what the Bible says. Today we have people who defend the Second Amendment, and I agree with the Second Amendment in the sense that the government does not have a right to take your gun by force or anything else you own, but the concept of you using your Second Amendment right, which the purpose of the Second Amendment was not to protect hunters and gun collectors, it was to protect the right to overthrow a tyrannical government by force, by violence, with muskets, with guns. And that's wrong. Jesus and the New Testament says, do not kill the tax collector. Do not shoot the government. Do not assassinate Caesar. Well, today people say, the slogan I've heard in various chats on Facebook and so forth is molon labe, which I'm told is a Greek phrase that means come and get it. I think it was Charlton Heston who said, you'll have to pry my gun from my cold, dead fingers. But, of course, Charlton Heston didn't expect to have cold, dead fingers. He expected to give the gun collector from the government the cold, dead fingers. Look at our economy today and how the government, through mercantilism and other unchristian forms of economic intervention, is destroying jobs. Suppose your next-door neighbor decides to get a job working for the government, and the job he's given by the government is to come knocking on your door and request that you give him your gun. You are making the choice. You're saying, nope, I'm not going to give you my gun, and I would rather that the kid next door be deprived of a father than to me be deprived of my gun. It's better for me to have a gun than it is for the kid next door to have a father. And if the kid's father next door gets a job with the government to take my gun, I will kill the kid next door's father so I can keep my gun. That's insane, and it's not Christian. And a Christian, let him be called a pacifist. Jesus was the Prince of Peace. Jesus was a pacifist. We'll talk about this in the next 365 days if you sign up for the Samuel Adams coaching program. The final word, the most hated word, number three, anarchism. Jesus prohibited his followers from being anarchists. Jesus said, do not impose your will on other people by force. Do not attempt to be charitable by taking money from other people and setting up a welfare system. The anarchist is a person who believes he has the right to impose his will on other people by force, and that is unchristian. Okay, here's another hated word. Actually, there's two possible ways to phrase this, but just as America's founding fathers did not make the mistake of embracing pessimillennialism and the rapture, so a bonus word, a word that we need to adopt, might be called optimillennialism, but a technical word is preterism. That's a word that more and more people are becoming familiar with, and some of them hate the word. But it's a word that meant that this planet has a future, and that it is proper and Christian to work for peace over the entire world, to advocate and work for the abolition, the eradication of empires and Führers and Caesars and Pharaohs, that this planet and peace on earth is a biblical ideal. Thing number five, the final of the five things you need to know and that we'll be talking about in the Samuel Adams coaching program, the three things you need to become extraordinary. One of the things you need to become extraordinary is the curriculum, the content of a colonial education, the content that Samuel Adams and Patrick Henry and John Hancock had. Even before they went to college, they had this content. They studied the Shorter Catechism. They read the Bible. They understood that they needed to exercise dominion over the earth and discharge a lawful calling. They knew this was how the world works. This is how the invisible hand orchestrates society to create the wealth of nations, a work that was published in the same year as the Declaration of Independence, 1776. But it's not enough to have the content. In fact, the content is here free of charge on this website. There are hundreds and hundreds of links on this website to all kinds of content. We'll tell you exactly the books you need to read, and you can go ahead and read them. But you haven't yet, and you probably won't, unless you have two other of the three things you need to become an extraordinary American, an extraordinary Christian, and an extraordinary human being. Those three things are a curriculum, and a coach, and a community. The content is important because ideas have consequences, but a coach is important because you need someone to hold you accountable, a teacher, a mentor. And also, it's really helpful to have a community of kindred spirits, like-minded people who you gain support from them. And also, you can challenge ideas. We're all commanded to grow. We're all commanded, like the Bereans, to search the scriptures and see if what we're being told is true. And it helps for a little of the iron sharpening iron that the Proverbs mentioned. But let's look at the five books that we're going to look at, we're going to read in the next 365 days in the Samuel Adams coaching program. This is the curriculum that I think that Samuel Adams had, the Founding Fathers had, and if you read these five works, it will transform you, provided you keep in mind the five things you need to know and ask the three questions that stem from those three hated words and those three mistakes that America's Founding Fathers made. Cut out the mainstream media for one year, for 1 hour a day, and during that hour, read these five works. If you enroll in the program, we'll send out an email every day that here's your assignment, and not only will you get the assignment, we'll get it read to you. You'll have an audio file you can download. You can listen to your assignment as you're commuting to work or as you're exercising or washing the dishes or whatever. We also have live webinars where we get together, ask questions, check these ideas. Some people will say, well, no, I'm not sure I agree with that. Obviously, there's a lot here in this program. It's very controversial. It's designed to challenge you, to wake you up, to get you out of your slumbers. And there'll be time for interaction with other members, other students in the coaching program in live webinars. There's office hours, 15-minute laser coaching sessions, unlimited email. This is really the equivalent of a couple of years of college. You're reading these textbooks and you're discussing them on a, I hate to say an intellectual level, an American level, a Christian level, a way that's supposed to really result in practical transformation. We're not here to flunk you. We're not here to give you an F. We're here to try to make sure that you are transformed into an extraordinary American, an extraordinary Christian, and an extraordinary human being. The ideas in the five most important works in the history of Western civilization are important ideas, and the reason why they're important is because ideas have consequences, and bad ideas have bad consequences, and good ideas have really good consequences. And ideas are really what motivate people. There are sometimes religious ideas, and most importantly, in history, we've seen how civilizations, we've seen how movements, we've seen how dictatorships have emerged from ideas, because they create a sense of inevitability. When somebody says, holds before us a lofty ideal and a concept and a critique of the status quo, it generates this optimism in followers, in adherents of those ideals. Islam creates a sense of inevitability. They believe that they're eventually going to turn the entire world into a caliphate or whatever they believe in. The Marxists had a sense of inevitability. Homosexuals today say that Christians are on the wrong side of history. History is also important for us to understand in order to avoid the mistakes. You may have heard that phrase, that if you don't learn from history, you'll make the same mistakes. Another aspect of our curriculum is that it's a daily curriculum, 365 days. The Bible over and over says we're to daily be in the Word, to daily check the Scriptures against what we're told, and doing religion and morality and knowledge on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday has a way of transforming your daily life because you no longer relegate religion to Sunday. You actually see that religion has to do with all areas of your life every day of the week. So here are the five books. Obviously, the most important book in the history of the human race, and certainly the most important book in the history of America, is the Bible. The Bible is the basis for the public school system. The reason why the Protestant reformers and early American settlers created public schools, or common schools, schools for everybody, is because they believed the Bible should not be locked up in the hands of the Vatican or the priests. It certainly shouldn't be left only to princes, but that everybody should have the Bible. Everybody should know the Bible because, as Wycliffe said in the 14th century, hundreds of years ago, the Bible is for the government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Maybe you've heard that from someone else. The Bible. We'll read the Bible in chronological order, and we'll read a little bit every day. It only takes about 10 minutes a day to read the entire Bible from cover to cover in 1 year. We'll read the Westminster Standards. As I've mentioned, the Shorter Catechism was in every single classroom in America. A population of 4 million people, there were 5 million copies of the Shorter Catechism in America in around 1776. We're going to read a book about theocracy and show why the separation of church and state is a myth. We're going to show why we must be a nation under God, under the true God. We're going to read a book that criticizes mercantilism. We mentioned the book called The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, written in the same year of the Declaration of Independence. The Wealth of Nations asks, why is it some nations are wealthy and others are poor? The answer is capitalism. So we'll be looking at that. And finally, we're going to look at this concept of optimillennialism. We're going to look at the reason why there really is a future for this planet. You know, there are some people who believe that the planet has no future. It's going to be destroyed even in the millennium. The 1,000 literal years that some people believe the book of Revelation teaches, even the millennium is a failure. At the end of the millennium, a lot of Christians believe Satan rebels against Jesus, the king, and Satan wins. And Jesus, basically, he's a loser. He has to take his football and go home. The whole concept, the whole creation of the world, the whole creation of planet Earth was a mistake in this view because it's a failure. The idea that human beings could turn a wilderness into a garden and a garden into the city of God, a failure. And I believe that's a mistaken understanding of the Bible. The Bible gives us hope. The Bible gives us promise. That's the reason the second Adam came, to undo the mistakes of the first Adam and to make sure that Adam's first responsibilities and duties were carried out, to exercise dominion over the earth and to turn the garden into the city of God. Optimillennialism, no more pessimillennialism. So those are the five books we're going to read a little bit every day for the next 365 days. Now, some of the other things that are on this checklist we'll discuss when we get there, but in this short audio, I want to try to keep it as short as I can. So we're going to skip to the second thing you need to become extraordinary, and that's a coach. The Bible says life is like a race. Life is like an athletic event. And if you want to win the gold medal in an athletic event, the first thing you would do, if you were smart, is hire a coach. What is coaching? Coaching is an encouraging person who's going to keep you mindful of the rules of the game and give you strategies which will overcome your opponent. The Bible describes the elder, the neighborhood elder in the Old Testament, the church elder in the New Testament, the older guide who's been there and done that and can help you avoid mistakes, avoid pitfalls, and succeed in your quest to win the race. There are experts which have knowledge that they've obtained, which can share with you and help you be a better Christian, a better American, a better human being. The grandfather in the scripture is commanded to teach the word of God to his children and his children's children. And if you don't have any grandparents, maybe what you need to do is become a grandfather to someone else who needs to be mentored, who needs to be tutored. A coach is also someone just like you. And it's good to have a fellow traveler, a friend, a companion, a kindred spirit. And that's why the third thing we need and that the Samuel Adams coaching program provides is a community of like-minded people, because we're supposed to work with one another. We're supposed to sharpen our wits by having conversations and vigorous conversations at that with other people. The Bible describes us as a priesthood of all believers. We need to be ministering to each other, and we are competent to engage in a serious effort to advance our winning the race. So we'll talk about how to be a coach. We'll talk about how you can work, and we're even willing to pay you to be a mentor in the Samuel Adams coaching program. And that paying you is a way to is a segue into the final section here we'll be talking about. And that is, there is a cost to this program. It costs money to administer a community online. It costs money to produce all the materials we have here. The laborer is worthy of his hire, Jesus said. So we'll talk in the next 95 days in our orientation program about how much this program is worth, how much you should pay for it. But here's the key thing. We offer a money-back guarantee. If the only way we can get you to enroll is to offer a double your money-back guarantee, we'll do that. You have to complete the assignments in a way that we prescribe. And if you don't think that you've experienced a massive personal transformation for your better, then we'll double your money back. In fact, we're willing to triple or quadruple your money back if you will agree to mentor someone else, to bring them into the Samuel Adams coaching program. We'll give you 60% of the enrollment fee that they pay, that your mentees pay. So that's an overview of what we'll be looking at in the next 95 days. It's an orientation program. We're going to discuss in detail the commitment that's involved in the Samuel Adams coaching program. There is a commitment. It takes a great deal of commitment to break the mainstream media habit, to cut out an hour of the mainstream media every day, and to read the five most important works in the history of Western civilization. It takes discipline, and you need to be accountable to someone, and you need to think about the commitment, and you need to be persuaded. This is a good thing. Now, you might disagree with some of the things that I've already articulated. You might, and I expect you to disagree. I almost expect it, that you'll disagree with our interpretation of the three mistakes the Founding Fathers made. You may say, oh no, we have rights. Oh no, it's okay to overthrow the government by force and violence. And no, we have to have representative government. Certainly you might find the three most hated words, you might hate them as much as the mainstream media hates them. But I'm guaranteeing you this, if you will search the scriptures and challenge what you're going to hear in the Samuel Adams coaching program, that simply hearing both sides and forcing yourself to think about them will result in an extraordinary transformation, a personal transformation unlike any you've ever experienced. As we go through the Bible, as we go through the book on capitalism, as we go through the Westminster Standards, we'll be asking those questions. Are we really entitled to everything we want, or are we obligated? Are we entitled or are we obligated? Are we authorized to rebel against tyrants, or are we commanded to be in subjection to tyrants? And the final most important question, would this world be better off or would it be worse off if all the archists retired, resigned, repented from being archists and went home and got a real job? And if you ask these three questions about expectations and rights, about rebellion against tyrants, rebellion against archists, and whether the world needs archists at all. Just asking these questions every day for the next 365 days will transform you like nothing else has. So I hope what you will do is this. I hope you'll enroll in the 95-day orientation. And we just ask for a tax-deductible donation of any amount. We suggest that a dollar a day is an appropriate donation, $95 for the 95-day orientation, an appropriate enrollment fee for this program. But any donation of any amount shows that you're willing to put some skin in the game and that you're not just here to cause distractions. Then we'll talk about what the overall 365-day program with the members area and your personal coach and the curriculum is worth and what you should pay for it. But you know what? In the end, it's all available for free here, and we'll let you get in one way or the other. But we want you to step up to the plate and accept that first personal responsibility of remembering that Jesus says the laborer is worthy of his hire. So put your name and your email in the box, and that's how you'll get started. and we'll be in touch with you, and we'll let you know the next step. And we'll just keep letting you know the next step until finally you've run through the entire race, and you'll be, I think, overjoyed with the transformation you will experience. So once again, this is Kevin Craig. I'm the founder of Vine and Fig Tree, a nonprofit, tax-exempt 501c3 educational organization which sponsors the Samuel Adams Coaching Program. And I hope you'll make that tax-deductible donation and get started with our 95-day orientation program.